Fume is a non-electrical, natural, wooden hand-crafted inhaler made to receive the benefits of essential oils, and it's the number one natural way to quit smoking. With Fume, you simply add the oil-infused core and inhale. They taste and smell absolutely amazing and curb cravings. Fume takes all of the benefits of super plants, behavioural science and beautiful design to make quitting smoking that bit easier. My personal favourite oil-infused cores are the peppermint one, as well as the black pepper one. They're great to unwind with after a stressful day, especially if you're trying to kick your smoking or vaping habit. Fume really is the perfect alternative. Furthermore, for each Fume that is sold, they feed 6 orphans. So not only are you getting an amazing product, you're supporting children in need. Just head to breathefume.com/morbidology. That is breathefume.com/morbidology and enter code morbidology for 10% off your order. You can even take a quiz to find out what cores are best suited for you. And definitely check out the Quit Naturally pack. Like most of you, I'm hoping that things will get back to normal soon and we can hang out with our friends, go to the bar and even travel. If you're wanting to keep yourself preoccupied while we wait for some normalcy, download Best Fiends. It's been keeping me preoccupied during the past while, and it's a great game filled with cute characters, which is a refreshing break from true crime writing. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. With Best Fiends, the fun never ends. There's thousands of levels and tons of characters. I'm on level 291, but there's new puzzles to solve each and every day. It's one of those games where 30 minutes really feels like 30 seconds. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and it's fun to play. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed, and when I need a break while writing. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. In December of 2015, Versailles, Kentucky was preparing for Christmas. Residents had decorated their homes in preparation for the festivities. In the quiet neighbourhood of Grey Street, there was one family home which had lit up in celebration, with decorations aplenty, including a Snoopy wearing a Christmas hat standing out front. One morning, however, the community would awake to the terrifying news that somebody had crept into this family's home armed with a knife. This person's actions inside that family home would strike fear into parents across the world. Logan Tipton was a 6-year-old boy who lived with his family in Versailles near Lexington. He was the youngest of 5 children and was a kindergartner at Simmons Elementary School. Here, he was known for always coming into class with a massive smile on his face. As Superintendent Scott Hawkins said, he was extremely well-liked. He had a lot of friends at the school. Just a great, great little boy, and one that you certainly loved having in your building. Logan also loved playing football and playing outside with his siblings whenever the weather permitted it. He had just recently joined the Woodford Youth Football League and really enjoyed playing with his friends. He was due to get a league reward for the most valuable offensive player, and all of his coaches said that he was a natural athlete. Logan was also extremely scared of the dark, but his mother Heather said that she would often sing the song Silent Night to help calm his fears. Shortly before 4 a.m. on the 7th of December 2015, an unknown male standing at 6 feet tall and weighing around 260 pounds entered the family's home through an unlocked door. He walked around the residence before grabbing a large butcher knife that was in the kitchen. From here, the man proceeded up the stairs and entered the bedroom that Logan shared with his 11-year-old sister. The unknown man walked up to Logan, who was fast asleep, and started to viciously stab him in the head area, as well as in the neck and back with the butcher knife. Logan's older sister, Coral, who'd been sleeping in the same bed as him, woke up, saw what was happening, and began to scream and attempted to pull the man off her younger brother. Her screams woke up their father, Dean, who rushed into the bedroom to find the unidentified man. Dean managed to get a hold of the man and hold him down while Coral rang 911.
You have a what? What's your address, ma'am? Please? Yes, where do you live? Do you know who it is?
No, I don't.
When police arrived at the scene, they found Logan to be suffering from numerous stab wounds to the head. They attempted to render first aid, but it was tragically already too late, and Logan was pronounced dead in his bedroom. Some of Logan's siblings had sustained cuts and scratches during the scuffle inside the bedroom, but they did not require hospital treatment. They were treated by paramedics at the home. The suspect would be identified as 32-year-old Ronald Exanthus, who is from Indianapolis. According to Logan's family, they had never seen the man before in their lives. It was now up to investigators to try and piece together why Ronald had travelled 200 miles, entered a random family's home, and targeted a little boy who wasn't able to defend himself. Police Lieutenant Michael Fortney said, "We're all kind of bumping our heads against a wall. It's mind-boggling. We legitimately, at this point, don't know how this guy got to Frasier's. We have no correlation. There is no family, no nothing." As soon as Ronald was arrested, a defense attorney that had been appointed to represent him, Bridget Hoffler, questioned his mental competency.
"The case is very anomalous. It's unlike any of the 8 capital cases that I represent. This gentleman has absolutely no ties to this family, no ties to Kentucky. He's never been in Kentucky except to drive through it, to my knowledge, to get to Florida. And we know nothing. Our client's not able to really tell us much of anything. He's mainly delusional. When he's not delusional, it's been very difficult to communicate with him."
She said that during the arraignment, Ronald had been unresponsive, and when she asked him some basic questions about his background and family, he couldn't answer. He didn't know his mother's phone number, nor could he relay if or not he was employed and what he was doing in the town. She stated, "I have discussed various things with him on 2 separate occasions this morning, and he's not able to really discuss anything. He's not there." During the arraignment, Ronald would plead not guilty, and Judge Vanessa Dixon would set his bond at $1 million. Outside of court, defense Hoffler would reveal that she believed that Ronald may have been suffering from schizophrenia. She said, "I feel certain he is mentally ill. I'm not a psychologist, but I've dealt with a lot of people in my career." The senseless murder of Logan was the epitome of a nightmare for any parent on this earth. The notion that a complete stranger could enter your home and murder your child as they slept in their bed was absolutely terrifying, and the community recoiled in horror as the murder broke the headlines. Logan's aunt, Melissa Budgedahl, would say to the Associated Press, "Babies aren't supposed to have anything like this happen to them. You can't make sense of it. You just have to try and get through it. We're just trying to get through it." One neighbour, Tiffany Crow, said that the murder had scared her so much that she was going to make sure her home was more secure. The community would come together in the wake of the tragedy to provide support for Logan's family. They had just experienced the single worst thing that any parent could experience. Laura Burton, a family friend, would set up a GoFundMe to raise money for Logan's funeral, as well as counselling for his siblings and other expenses. In the space of just a few hours, the fundraiser would reach over $15,000. In total, it would reach over $57,000. Tributes for Logan would immediately come in, with the Woodford Youth Football League sharing a photograph alongside the caption, "Rest in peace, baby Logan. We will miss you. You were small, but you were fierce." Family friend and president of the Woodford Youth Football League, Peter Barnhart, said that Logan had a pure heart and never knew a stranger. He fondly recalled how he was always quick to tell people that he loved them, and that his heart was pure. A candlelight vigil was held for the young boy on the Monday night, on the field where he had played football for the Woodford Youth Football League. Over 200 locals would show up to honour Logan, and many echoed the same confusion as to how something this horrific could have happened within their community. Pastor Terry Jenkins urged the community to show love to one another, as they struggled to find a way to make it through this unimaginable tough time. Before the crowd, he said, "Senseless evil, random acts of violence, day and night, it can be found. None of us are immune to it." He assured them that Logan was in a better place, having awoken that morning from a dream world to a world where dreams come true. His father, Dean, would speak to the crowd to share his heartache and call Logan's sister a hero.
He's not right. As a father, your job is to protect your children. This girl right here, my oldest daughter, fought this guy off until I could get upstairs. She fought this grown man trying to kill him off until I got upstairs. I wasn't quick enough to get to Logan's.
Heather would lead the mourners in a rendition of Silent Night, singing her son's favorite song to him for one final time.
That's something I want everybody to help me with. And I'd like everybody to please help me sing that just one last time for
Silent Night, Holy Night.
Meanwhile, a call was sent out to parents at Simmons Elementary School to inform them of what had taken place. A statement was prepared for students at the school, and their teachers would read it aloud in their classrooms. A crisis team of counsellors was on hand to offer any support to the children as they tried to comprehend what had happened to their classmate and friend. On the Tuesday after the murder, a visitation was held, and the following day, Logan was laid to rest. His funeral was held at the Woodford Cove Football Stadium. Hundreds of mourners came to pay their final respects to a little boy that many of them didn't know, but a little boy that had captured their hearts. There wasn't a dry eye as Logan's dainty ivory casket was escorted to the 50-yard line, where his football jersey was waiting. Peter Barnhart, who'd coached Logan, informed the mourners that it was God's number one draft pick day. He said, "As coaches, all we ever asked for you was for your best, and we always said to give your team everything you have. And at the end of the day, if you're unable to walk off the field, we will come get you. We will carry you off the field. Logan, you kept your end of the deal. You gave us everything you had. Now it's our turn. Rest easy, little buddy."
Coach Pete was just preparing this young player for another coach who's standing on the sideline, and he's got long hair, and he's got a robe, and he's got scars in his hand, and he's giving Logan a high five because he said, "Logan, you scored the touchdown. Give me a high five." He said, "Yes, Jesus, Coach Jesus, we're doing this."
Logan's football teammates lined the football field as the coaches carried his casket to the awaiting hearse. His coach then picked up Logan's helmet and raised it high into the air as the stadium erupted with cheers and applause. Understandably, Logan's family, in particular his siblings, did not want to return to the home where Logan had lost his life. The family's church announced that they would be helping to move the family's possessions out of the home and put what they didn't need immediately into storage. Some of the money raised by the community would be going towards the Tipton family finding a new rental accommodation. Early the following year, Ronald appeared in court and pleaded not guilty to the murder of Logan, as well as to charges of first-degree burglary, second-degree assault, and fourth-degree assault. During the court hearing, defense Hoffler said that she was no closer to understanding or explaining to the public why or how Ronald ended up in Logan's home on the 7th of December. She emphasized that he was not a thug and that the crime had not stemmed from a drug deal or robbery. She said, "This gentleman has absolutely no ties to this family, no ties to Kentucky. He's never been in Kentucky, except to drive through it to get to Florida. We know nothing. Our client is not really able to tell us much of anything." She revealed more about Ronald, stating that he was a professional, an upper middle class man, who was employed as a nurse, and who had spent all of his adult life employed. She said that numerous physicians from Indianapolis, where Ronald worked, had contacted her to say that Ronald deals day to day with end-stage renal failure patients, and that he was the most loving human that they had ever known, and that they couldn't reconcile the Ronald they knew with the Ronald who had been accused of such a brutal and senseless murder. It was evident from the defense's statement that this was going to be an extremely complex case. The first thought within the community was that Ronald was a thug and had been on drugs at the time of the murder. However, it soon became apparent that that wasn't the case. While it was known what had taken place inside the home, nobody was any closer to uncovering why it had taken place. It's estimated that 30 million women are impacted by weakened or thinning hair. If you're one of them, then just know that you're not alone and there is a solution, Nutrafol. Nutrafol offers two targeted formulas for women that are clinically shown to improve your hair growth and hair thickness with less shedding. In fact, in a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after just 6 months, with more than 1,500 top doctors recommending Nutrafol. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support my show by going to Nutrafol.com and entering the promo code Morbidology to save $15 off your first month subscription. This is the best offer anywhere and it is only available to US customers for a limited time, plus free shipping on every order. Get $15 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com with promo code Morbidology. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Following the hearing, defense Hoffler would speak with Heather and expressed her sorrow for her loss. She told Heather that Ronald's mother had asked her to apologize to her and let her know how sorry they were for what their son had done. Heather simply responded and said that it wasn't their fault. Meanwhile, Heather would provide a statement on behalf of the family, thanking the community for all of their support during the unimaginably tough time. She said, "I just wanted to thank the whole community and everybody that's behind us for your support and your prayers. Please continue to keep us in your prayers, especially my kids." Commonwealth's attorney, Gordy Shaw, would file a notice that he would be seeking the death penalty for Ronald if convicted of the murder. And in early November, Judge Rob Johnson would rule that Ronald was competent to stand trial. A psychiatric evaluation had found that Ronald had heard voices and had exhibited bizarre behaviours before carrying out the murder, but said that after treatment, he understood the consequences of his actions and he could assist in his defence. The murder trial was scheduled for March of 2018, and due to pretrial publicity, it was moved from Versailles to Fayette County. Still, the public knew very little about the case and what had motivated Ronald to drive all the way to a stranger's home and kill an innocent boy. Public defender Kim Green wrote in a pretrial motion, "This may be the most complex case that defence counsel has ever handled." It would be disclosed before the trial that in the lead-up to the murder, people who knew Ronald said that he had been acting very erratically and uncharacteristic, and that he had barely been eating or sleeping. Furthermore, both the defence and the prosecution had examined Ronald, and both agreed that he was psychotic at the time of the murder. However, the defence would be arguing during trial that Ronald was legally insane, which meant that the burden of proof would be upon the defence team to prove this. Following Ronald's arrest, he had been admitted to the State Correction Psychiatric Centre, and here he reported that he had been hearing voices speaking in Creole. These voices, he said, did not command him to do things, but instead, they spoke very negatively about him. The prosecution would be planning on arguing that Ronald's bizarre behaviour had been caused by the ingestion of synthetic marijuana, bath salts, or some other kind of disassociative drug. His defence team completely denied that there was any kind of evidence that their client had ingested such drugs. The prosecution stated that it would be up to the jury to decide whether Ronald was in fact psychotic, and if so, if he was so psychotic enough that he was unable to act knowingly. It had become apparent by this point that the crux of the case would be whether Ronald was legally insane or whether his behaviour was caused by taking synthetic drugs. It was going to be the first death penalty trial in Fayette County since 2015, when Joel David Searcy was put on trial for the robbery and murder of Donald Cook. The defence would not be denying that Ronald had stabbed and killed Logan. Under the law, there needed to be two elements present to prove that a murder had occurred, the first of which is the act and the second of which is a culpable mindset. The defence would be arguing that Ronald did not have a culpable mindset because of mental illness.
When you have viewed all the evidence, we will ask you to bring back a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity, because that is the truth.
During opening statements, the prosecution lambasted the defence's argument of insanity, stating that it did not fly as a defence because Ronald had voluntarily taken some kind of synthetic drug, which had then caused his psychosis. Conjuring this, Defence Hoffler said, "The Commonwealth is looking for a drug that is not there. Mental illness, not a drug, is why Ron is here and why Logan is not." She said that a blood sample taken from Ronald showed only the presence of a non-active ingredient of marijuana. The first witness to testify during the murder trial was Logan's 13-year-old sister, Coral. She described how she had woken up to see a man standing over her little brother with a butcher knife in one hand and a butter knife in the other hand.
He comes at me with the butter knife and I try grabbing it out of his hand and I get the knife in my hand and he asks for it back and I said, "Yes, sir." I gave it back to him and then he came at me with it again, going up my stomach to my face and cut my nose.
She said to the courtroom that she had confronted Ronald and he came towards her and ran the butter knife up her abdomen all the way up to her face. Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Keith Eardley presented a bent butcher knife. He showed it to Coral and she said, "That is the knife he used to stab Logan." The 911 call that Coral had placed was played out to the jury. She said to the 911 operator that her father was struggling with the intruder inside the bedroom, stating, "Daddy's upstairs telling him to stop." Their father, Dean, would testify and tell the courtroom that Logan was always the first one to meet him at the door when he came home from work each evening. He said that the house had been left unlocked on the 7th of December so that his wife, Heather, could get in after working her shift at Amazon. Typically, she had a key to get in, but Logan had recently broken her key in the back door lock. He described the moment he rushed into his children's bedroom to find Ronald. He said to the jury, "I told him that I was going to kill him because he was messing with my children.
I hustle up to the top of the stairs, and when I get to the top of the stairs, he's standing there, and he's coming down with a knife to try to stab me with
a
knife."
He's coming to you with a knife?
Yes.
when police arrived at the scene and handcuffed Ronald. He rushed to Logan and held him in his arms as his son took his final breaths.
And it wasn't 10 seconds later. He just... He looked kind of glanced up at me, closed his eyes, and that was it. He died in my arms.
Dean was then cross-examined by defense attorney Josh Miller. He confirmed that he had never seen Ronald before that night, when he saw him in his children's bedroom, armed with a knife. Up until the trial, there had been a lot of rumors circulating around the community. It was more comforting for people to think that this was a personal murder instead of a completely random one. He asked whether it could have been motivated because of an old debt, insurance, or a deal gone wrong. He asked, "This is not your fault, is it?" To which Dean replied, "No, it is not." After Dean's testimony, a video of Ronald being interviewed following the stabbing was played out for the jury. Ronald explained that he was driving to visit his mother in Florida when he became lost before parking on Gray Street, where the Tipton family lived. He said he stopped here in particular because it reminded him of the TV show Grey's Anatomy. In the interview, Ronald spoke about Grey's Anatomy quite often, saying that his car was parked there.
How did you get the for sale specimen at your house? Where did you park?
It's out there on Grey's Anatomy.
Do you just happen to walk through this house and see a child and then decide to stab him?
No, it's not Grey's Anatomy. And then I thought surgery.
Okay.
Yes.
And where did you stab this child?
In the head.
He told the detective that Grey's Anatomy reminded him of knives for surgery, and he decided that he would try to perform a surgery. According to his defense, he had binge-watched the TV show in the days leading up to the stabbing.
Ron said, "I saw Grey's and figured I saw Grey Road, and that made me think of knives for surgery. I reenacted surgery."
He said that during the drive, he kept changing his mind about whether or not he wanted to complete the trip. But ultimately, he ended up lost. When he was asked about where his car was, he replied, "It's out there on Grey's Anatomy." Ronald further said to the detective that he had felt resentment that his six-year-old daughter was living with her mother and stepfather in Indiana, and admitted that he had grabbed the knife and stabbed Logan repeatedly in the head. He acknowledged that Dean was angry and upset, that his son had been attacked, and he understood exactly why. When he was asked by the investigator, "What do you think should happen to somebody who stabbed a child in the head?" he replied, "They should go to jail." He was then asked what should happen if the child had died, and he replied, "They should get the chair. They should get punished." It was at this moment that Ronald was informed that Logan had died from the attack that he had committed. He fell silent before saying that he was feeling pain at the news that Logan had died from the attack. This interview was with Police Detective Keith Ford, who would testify that Ronald had came across as very lucid and candid during his interview, while Officer Jonathan Gaylor testified that when he was driving Ronald from the police station to jail, he said that he was very sorry about what he had done.
He said in the interview that he had resentment, and I asked him what the resentment was about, and he said he was mad at the world. He said no, and he just said that it was about Ariana. And then we talked about who Ariana was and determined it was his daughter.
When Ronald was being booked into jail, his demeanor completely changed. While being interviewed, he had been polite and cooperative. The video footage of him being booked into the jail showed that he was refusing to cooperate. Defence Green, who was laying the groundwork for their insanity defence, asked Officer Gaylor whether he had observed that Ronald couldn't recall having his Miranda rights read to him less than 2 hours beforehand. She also stated that Ronald claimed he had been forced to the side of the road by investigators when this hadn't happened. He had been arrested at the Tipton family home. He confirmed that he had ticked yes on a jail intake sheet, which asked whether Ronald had exhibited behaviours indicating mental illness, and confirmed that he had ticked no on the sheet, asking whether Ronald had consumed a dangerous amount of alcohol or drugs. Jason Berry, who had worked analysing blood and urine samples at the Kentucky State Police Lab, would then tell the courtroom that a sample of blood taken from Ronald showed the presence of an inactive ingredient in marijuana. He said that he did not test for synthetic marijuana. Another video would be played for the jury depicting the chaos at the crime scene. The video was literally like a nightmare. There were children screaming, adults cursing, and the ever-present flashing lights from the police cars outside. As Ronald is led to the police car outside, somebody can be heard shouting, "Why don't you show some remorse?" while another hollers, "What the hell did you do to that little boy?" Dr. William Ralston, the chief medical examiner, would tell the courtroom that Logan had died from sharp force injuries to the head, neck, and back. He had been stabbed with such force that part of the blade broke in the back of his head. He said that Logan bled to death in a matter of minutes. The prosecution would rest their case, and now it was time for the defence to present theirs. After all, the burden of proof was on them. Their first witness would be Lauren Burgess, who had been engaged to Ronald. They had been together since September of 2013, and she had moved in with him around a year before the murder. She said that she and Ronald frequently smoked marijuana, but said that he never exhibited adverse effects. She said that she had noticed he had stopped eating and his behaviour had become peculiar. She mentioned one specific event when they had gone to an Indianapolis church service, where her father was baptised. She said that Ronald became agitated and started to cry. She said to the courtroom, he kept rambling on, saying things that didn't make sense. He said things like, I look death in the face every day.
He was still kind of crying. He kept pointing to one pastor saying he was a detective.
Was that pastor a detective too?
No. No, he just was kind of blurting out stuff that didn't make sense.
Following the service, Ronald collapsed on one knee and proposed to Lauren, but while doing so, he was crying hysterically. The proposal had come completely out of the blue, because the couple had never even spoken about marriage beforehand. From here, they went to a Taco Bell where Ronald kept babbling on about his job and how much he loved his patients. Then later on that day, Ronald told Lauren that he didn't want to be with her and didn't actually want to marry her. Under cross-examination from attorney Eardley, Lauren would acknowledge that Ronald hadn't shown any bizarre behaviour as they went engagement ring shopping. Then on the night of the 6th of December 2015, Ronald put on his shoes and left the apartment that he shared with Lauren. The following day, investigators showed up at her home to check on her, because after killing Logan, Ronald had claimed to them that he also killed Lauren. It's now been 20 years since the tragic events of 9/11, and despite all those years, many of us remember it like it was just yesterday. America, and even the rest of the world, hasn't been the same since. Raphaelian Media, the King of the World podcast series, explores the impact of that day for the American Muslim community through the eyes of the host, who's a high school senior at the time. The 7-part series delves into what it has been like as a Muslim living in America these past 20 years. It's presented in a unique and accessible way, covering important topics such as identity, belonging, mental health, and even attempted murder, alongside related international events of the last 20 years, including the war on terror, spying, discrimination, and fear of others. If you're a fan of long-form series such as Serial or the 1619 Project, then The King of the World is for you. Subscribe to King of the World now, wherever you get podcasts. Her testimony would be followed by testimony from co-workers. Dr. Angela Schrader, medical examiner of the Indiana Dialysis Unit where Ronald had worked, said, "Never did I see anything but exemplary behavior."
At least the hospital I worked in, okay, the only drugs he had access to were iron, sometimes an antibiotic, and heparin, which is a blood thinner.
She also said she never received any complaints that Ronald appeared to be intoxicated. Prosecutor Eardley questioned if she would be surprised to learn that Ronald often smoked marijuana, to which she replied, "I never saw any poor judgment." He revealed that during an interview, Ronald admitted that he took hydrocodone without a prescription, to which Dr. Schrader said that if she knew this, she would have been concerned about patient care. Rex Nottage, who was Ronald's high school football coach, said that he was one of the best linebackers he had ever coached. However, he admitted that Ronald often had mood swings, and would sometimes take himself out of a game. During these episodes, Ronald wouldn't even acknowledge Rex's presence. Robin Wildman, who knew Ronald through his work, said that he was very grounded, quiet, and extremely focused. He also said it would surprise him to learn that Ronald took drugs. The defense would then call on Dr. Kenneth Benedict, a psychologist who'd evaluated Ronald, to testify.
My major conclusion is that Mr. Xantus suffers from a major mental illness, and at the time of this tragic event was in the midst of a psychotic episode.
He said that he had concluded that Ronald had been suffering from a major mental illness and was in the midst of a psychotic episode when he attacked Logan. He said that while he couldn't specify what kind of mental illness Ronald had been suffering from, he believed that it could have been schizophrenia. While being questioned by public defender Green, Dr. Benedict acknowledged that substance-induced psychosis disorder needed to be considered as a possibility, but added that that was not the most likely diagnosis in his opinion. A psychiatrist from the Kentucky Correctional Psychiatric Center reported that Ronald's psychosis was most likely caused by some kind of substance. The attorney questioned whether a test that Dr. Benedict had administered to Ronald indicated that he was malingering symptoms of mental illness, and Dr. Benedict responded that part of the test results had questioned whether his performance was consistent. He further said in his evaluation that Ronald had no prior criminal history or psychiatric evaluations. However, Attorney Greenup revealed that back in 2010, Ronald had injured his infant daughter by shaking her. Dr. Benedict responded, "I'm aware of that. It's my understanding that no criminal charges came from that." To which Attorney Greenup said, "So if a person had not been charged or acquitted, it would make no difference to you in a psychological workup." Ronald's older sister, Maggie, would speak to the courtroom about her brother's behaviour following his arrest. She said that when she spoke to him, he wasn't making any sense. She was overcome with emotion as she said, "When he talked, you could just tell it wasn't him." Ronald was moved to the Kentucky Correctional Psychiatric Center, where he was given medication. Maggie said that after taking the medication, her brother became more talkative and more like himself. Edward Barberi, a forensic toxicologist, would next testify that he had done a drug screen on a blood sample that was taken from Ronald shortly after his arrest. He said that no drugs were found in the sample. However, he said that the lab had received the blood sample 18 months after it was taken from Ronald, and that over time drug compounds can degrade. He also acknowledged that the lab could not find all synthetic cannabinoids. Following his testimony, it would be time for closing arguments to be presented. Attorney Eardley said, "Is he insane? I don't think so," before saying that Ronald should be found guilty of the murder of Logan. And then he showed the jury the bent knife with which Logan had been stabbed to death. He chillingly stated, "Think of the force used in that knife." He said that evidence presented showed that Ronald knew what he had done was wrong. He reminded the jury that when an investigator asked Ronald what he had done with the knife, he responded, "stabbed," before acknowledging that he had killed Logan. During a body camera recording, when police approached him at the Tipton home, Ronald had said, "I'm sorry, God." Then while being booked at the jail, he had asked for an attorney. According to Attorney Eardley, this showed that Ronald had appreciated the criminality of what he had done inside the Tipton home. Public defender Green, however, said that Ronald should be found not guilty by reason of insanity, because his mental illness had prevented him from obeying the law. She stated, "We have shown you that Ron was insane."
"But this is insanity. There is no intentionality. There is no knowing this. This is a tragic, insane nightmare."
She went on to say that while in the psychiatric center, on one occasion, Ronald had gotten down on all fours and started to bark like a dog. On another occasion, he ripped out his dreadlocks. The jury, consisting of 7 men and 5 women, were then sent off to deliberate. There were multiple verdicts that they could choose from, including not guilty, not guilty by reason of insanity, guilty but mentally ill, or just plain old guilty. If found guilty, Ronald could be facing the death penalty. If found not guilty by reason of insanity, another hearing would be held to commit him to a psychiatric facility. She went on to say that many people had tried to make sense of the case, before adding that the thing about insanity is that there is no rationality. The jury would come back with a verdict. They found Ronald not guilty of murder by reason of insanity. However, they found him guilty for assaulting Dean and two of Logan's siblings, and would recommend a 20-year sentence. The verdict made very little legal or logical sense. Ronald was in the same mindset as he committed the assaults and the murder. It was an inconsistency to find him guilty of two, but not guilty by reason of insanity on the other. The 20-year sentence that he was handed down meant that he would be eligible for parole before the end of the following year. However, that didn't necessarily mean that he would be granted parole. Outside of court, Logan's mother, Heather, said that she felt as though justice had not been served for her son. She said that Logan's siblings were heartbroken and confused by the decision of the jury. She revealed that Logan's sister, Dakota, had been stabbed in the back in the attack. She was now 9 years old and questioned, "Mommy, if he stabbed me first and then he killed Logan, how is he guilty of stabbing me but is not guilty of killing Logan?" The following month, Ronald would be in court to be formally sentenced to 20 years in prison. The sentencing hearing was preceded by a march downtown which consisted of around 150 loved ones of Logan in protest of the verdict. At the courthouse, Heather asked for a moment of silence for Logan, while his grandmother Joyce started to chant that the verdict did not fit the crime. Before the sentence was handed down, Coral provided a victim impact statement. She said that the verdict felt as though Logan didn't matter, before addressing Ronald. She said, "I want you to know that you're lucky that me and my dad didn't kill you." Heather then provided her own victim impact statement. She asked everybody to pray for Logan's siblings, who were forced to watch their brother be murdered in their bedroom. Turning to Ronald, she said, "When you murdered my son, you slaughtered my entire family. None of us are the same." She said that one day she will end up forgiving him, but that would be for her sake, not his. Dean said that the verdict was an example of what was wrong in America. He said that mass shootings occur because those who carry them out don't fear punishment. He stated, "They're not scared of the time they're going to get." Before the sentence was handed down, Ronald was asked if he wanted to say anything. He turned down the opportunity, leading Coral to shout, "You had plenty to say that night," before she started to cry. 2 years after the sentence was handed down, the Kentucky Supreme Court would consider the legitimacy of the contradictory verdicts that the jury had handed down. Ronald had appealed the assault convictions, arguing that if his insanity meant that he was found not guilty of the murder, then he should have been found not guilty of the assaults as well. Defence Karen Meyer said to the Supreme Court, "Nothing Ron did was calculated, planned, or premeditated. He went somewhere he had never been before, broke into a house he had never been to before, and attacked people he had never known. Ron's psychosis was present before, during, and after the crimes." In this court hearing, Assistant Attorney General Thomas Van de Rothstein said that immediately after the attack, Ronald appeared much more lucid. He begged Dean not to hurt him and even offered paramedics advice on how to perform CPR on Logan. He also expressed remorse and said he understood why Dean was so angry at him. He said that based on the narrative, it was logical that jurors concluded that Ronald had come to his senses midway through the attack and was therefore responsible for what he had done. He stated, "Any of us who are familiar with mental health, Alzheimer's, dementia, all kinds of things, there are moments of lucidity. Some mental states can be very fluid. They can change rapidly in either direction." Ultimately, the Kentucky Supreme Court would uphold the conviction of Ronald. Ronald's parole was recently deferred for 2 years, meaning that in 2023, Ronald has a shot at parole.
I'll never be able to wrap my arms around him again and hear him say, "Daddy, I miss you. I'm glad you're home." I'm never going to get that again. But this man has hope.
I can't explain that to my children. I will never be able to. But I get to deal with the aftermath for the rest of their lives for the rest of my life.
Home is the one place on this earth that you're supposed to feel safe. Tucked up in their bed at night, it's the one place that children should be safe. But on that fateful night in 2015, the epitome of a nightmare for every parent fell upon the Tipton family. While a trial and conviction can often bring some semblance of closure for surviving victims of crime, the outcome of this case really felt like a slap in the face of justice for the Tipton family. Not only did they lose their little boy, they and their other children have been left with a lifetime of trauma and the thought that one day the man who stabbed their son to death will be a free man. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Erin, Isabel, Poppy, and Karen. If you'd like to join me on Patreon, the link is in the show notes, or you can just search Morbidology on the app or on the website. In return for your support up on Patreon, I send out a handwritten thank you card, as well as some cool merch. I also upload ad-free and early release episodes, as well as full-length bonus episodes each month. It's a cool place to chat about cases I cover on the podcast, and I am eternally grateful for the support. I'm just back from a vacation to Spain, and before that I was at CrimeCon in London, where I had the best time. It was amazing to meet some of my listeners, as well as those who read the website and my books. A big special mention for James, who came with his daughter and flew from New York, Kat from Scotland, who I remembered from a lovely review she had left, and D&B from Wales, who were the absolute loveliest and so funny. Thanks to everybody who stopped by my table and said hello. I am eternally grateful. I also finally got to meet one of my best friends, Eileen, who co-hosts The Shattered Window with me, and who also hosts Crime Lapse. We both live in Ireland, but because of restrictions, we couldn't cross the border to meet up. I also met the lovely Rena from Handcuffed, and Joe and Emma from Murder, She Spoke, and our little group won the True Crime Quiz on the Saturday night. It was such a good weekend, and I got to hang out and have some beers with Sinead from Men's Ray, Mike from Murder Mile, Bob and Ali from Twisted Britain, Paul from The True Crime Enthusiast, Susie from Dark Side, the Captain from True Crime Garage, John and Sally from True Crime Investigators UK, Soham from A Sight for Sore Eyes, Jeffrey and Molly from Blood Ties, Terry from Crimepedia, Bethan from Seeing Red, Esther from Once Upon a Crime, Sarah from Conning the Con, Caprice from The Unseen, Rosanna and Ben from They Walk Among Us, Chantelle from Lady Justice, Aaron and Justin from Generation Y, Jeremy Renner from The Philosophy of Crime, and everybody else who was there, including my longtime friend LJ from Dystopian Simulation Radio. If you're looking for a new true crime podcast, check any of them out. It was such an amazing group, and everybody was so welcoming and friendly, which is always a massive bonus in these kinds of situations, especially after the isolated year that we've all had. I'm going to be at CrimeCon in London again next year, and tickets are on sale now. Head on over to crimecon.co.uk and use the code WINDOW, as in the shattered window, for 10% off. I genuinely can't recommend it enough, and don't be afraid of coming alone. You won't be alone for long. If I met you there over the weekend, hit me up on social media and we can keep in touch. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing podcast, Dystopian Simulation Radio. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
What's the going price for a human cadaver?
Has there ever been any physical evidence of an alien encounter?
Which rodent is the most likely to be possessed by a demon?
What do communism and the Loch Ness Monster have in common?
Did the US Army actually build a robotic shark?
If you have the questions, we have the answers.
Join me, Linz.
And me, Chris.
As we explore unexplained and unusual cases worldwide on Dystopian Simulation Radio.
Listen on Spotify, Apple Music, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Instagram at d.s.radio.